Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. This morning, we're broadcasting from the Nationwide Live Studio at the Memorial Tournament at Muirfield Village Golf Club in Dublin. It is the 40th anniversary of Muirfield Village development that has helped transform Northwest Franklin County. Led by golfing legend Jack Nicklaus, developers turned cornfields and forests into one of Ohio's most prestigious neighborhoods, home to one of the PGA Tour's most prestigious tournaments. Dublin and other suburbs have continued to sprawl, but their planners also are starting to think inward by encouraging higher density housing in a walkable city core. This hour, we look at America's changing suburb. Joining us now is Doug Buchanan. He's managing editor at Business First. Welcome back to the show, Doug.
Good morning.
And also with us is Dublin's director of strategic initiatives, Terry Fogler. Welcome to the show, Terry. Terry, let's start with you. Let's look back. 40 years ago, Jack Nicklaus proposed building a PGA tournament golf club and housing development. How do we measure the impact of this development on Central Ohio's overall suburban growth?
Well, if you think about that time frame, the late 60s, when Jack announced he had selected among the sites he was looking at the Dublin area. In 1970, Dublin's population was about 600 and change. 270 hadn't been built yet. When that selection was made in 1970, shortly after that, we had Ashland Chemical, really being the first major business, select this location. Collectively, they pushed for what had not been planned, the 33-270 interchange. A picture of that wasn't in place today, in terms of having driven everything from Honda to the west and all the other development. So those were really the catalysts that got the development going. From that 600 population, this set the tone for the nature and the character and the planning and the open space that I think characterizes a lot of Dublin and suburban development. Ashland Chemical set the tone for the kind of suburban corporate office setting that was there. So right out of the chute, when you had very little of Dublin developed, you had two really great, well-planned developments that kind of set the tone for development to come. And I think that kind of planning, that dedication to planning, the dedication to open space and design were really hallmarks then that led to both guiding of residential as well as office and commercial development in Dublin for the next 40, 50 years.
Doug Buchanan, how do you think it set the tone for the rest of the region?
Well, I think it showed the way that suburbs can develop. If you look at the amount of office space, for example, in Dublin, it dwarfs all the other suburbs. And I think you're seeing some of that catch-up being played, especially like if you look at New Albany, which is really turning into a rival for some of the new, bigger developments for Dublin. They are doing very similar things with planning out their business park, putting the incentives in place, putting the transportation planning in place. And, you know, that template is really showing a lot of success over there on the northeast side.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We are broadcasting from the Nationwide Live Studio at the Memorial Tournament at Muirfield Village in Dublin. We're talking about America's changing suburb. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. Dublin's encouraging major development in its city center now. Large condo and apartment complexes, street-level retail, sidewalks, new parks. Worthington is doing more of the same. Powell as well. Condo complexes have gone up in Upper Arlington. A big change there. Why the sudden push, or is it couldn't be that sudden because these things take planning, but why the push for suburbs to grow inward like that? Terry?
I think part of it from Dublin's perspective, when I came back as city manager around 2009, 2010, part of what interested me in the challenges facing suburbs was the understanding that the demographics that drove our development the previous 40 years were changing radically. The stuff that drove this form, which was really the baby boomers coming of age, having families, buying these houses, driving the level of construction of single-family detached housing, working in the suburbs near where they lived, was the predominant force of really urban growth in general nationally. And that's why the suburbanization of all metropolitan areas was such a dominant form. If you look forward at what's happening with demographics, with the baby boomers turning 65 in 2010, 10,000 baby boomers becoming 65 every day for the next 20 years, and look at the relative share of folks who were baby boomers the last 20, 40 years, where it used to be close to 80% of the growth of households in the last 40 years, it's down to 20 or 30% of the growth in the next 30, 40 years. It's a much different growth going forward. So I think the notion that the drivers are different demographically, and secondly, the idea that from an economic development perspective, young employees, young talent, the ability to attract and retain young talent is a critical part of predicting economic success. And those folks increasingly are seeking different kind of environments. They're seeking walkable, mixed-use kind of environments. We see that in the Short North in Columbus and other kind of urban neighborhoods. So from an economic development perspective, the idea of having those kind of environments when we have 60,000 people at work here every day becomes really important, we believe, to our long-term economic development success. The one other component is the substantial rise in senior-headed households. That's the largest percentage growth by far. Close to 60% of all household growth going forward is going to be the senior-headed households. And those empty nesters are going to be increasingly selling these four-bedroom homes in Dublin and other locations. And many of them want to stay in the community. But they, too, like the young professionals, are seeking these dense, walkable, mixed-use environments.
It's not just radical, right, Doug? It's rapid change.
Well, yeah, and I think that, you know, if you look at, again, from the economic development side, from the financing side of these projects, success is going to breed success. If you start seeing these kinds of developments succeed in Columbus or Dublin, or wherever, then the developers and the banks are going to start looking for more opportunities to do that elsewhere to see if there, you know, are similar opportunities. And they'll chase those opportunities. And so far, as you said, it's rapidly been shown that these developments succeed. And so it's easy to get financing for them.
Well, for the economic well-being of this of the Dublin area, it's not just important to attract young people, but also keep the older people.
Yeah, I think that I mean, we're becoming an incredibly more diverse population by kind of every measure. But I think this notion of lifelong communities where a young professional can be attracted here because there are housing and living and amenities that attract them when they do become the age they choose to marry, and if they choose to have families, we have a housing stock for that. And as they age and they want to remain in the community and stay connected, you want opportunities within various kinds of housing and neighborhoods for that. And it's great, and you're seeing this in the urban neighborhoods of Columbus, that what that empty nester group is seeking and what that young professional group is seeking align very much in many ways.
Right, and I think that had been a knock on Dublin several years ago, that there were, you know, there was a narrow strata of single-family homes, upper-income single-family homes, and there weren't enough of these starter homes. There weren't enough of the empty nester homes to accommodate everybody who wanted to move here. And I think that's been changing as well.
Baby boomers retiring, kids have left. They don't want to take care of large houses and yards anymore. How easy is it? How do you make it easy for seniors to stay?
I mean, the challenge is, I don't think it's just about building a building. I think the challenge facing suburbs and the region as a whole is how do you figure out where you can create enough critical mass for this kind of mixing of uses to create these environments. A housing product by itself doesn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
It takes housing that can walk to parks, housing that can walk
right
to jobs, housing that can walk to entertainment venues and restaurants and those other kind of elements there. That takes a lot of large-scale master planning, and you want those pieces to fit together. So a big part of Dublin's challenge and what we've invested a lot in the last 3 or 4 years has been the master planning of that entire 1,000-acre Bridge Street district, and then figuring out where to begin. How do you change a regulatory environment that was all built about
right
large-scale,
yeah,
low-density, single-family detached?
Suburbs, right.
I mean, the township that Dublin started in was the first township in Franklin County to have zoning. So there's a long tradition of that here.
Yeah.
But it's a totally different kind of zoning. You're building a grid of streets. You want density along that grid. You want mixing of uses along that grid. And Dublin has moved forward and developed a code and adopted a code that's completely geared towards accommodating and encouraging that form of development.
And if you look at the plans for Bridge Park next to the Scioto River, as part of this Bridge Street district, that is what you are seeing. You are seeing these kinds of housing and offices and walkable streets. I mean, that's all, you know, part of what they are encouraging and what the developer Crawford Hoying has agreed to build there. And it looks you know, different from anything that you would expect to see, especially in a suburb.
And certainly 40 years ago when this first, when they first broke soil for the construction of Muirfield, was there ever any pushback? Was this hard to get people on board because it was, it's such a change from what was envisioned?
Tell you the truth, I'm not aware of the history at the time. Mm-hmm. When it was a small village and it was a village of a few hundred people, I'm sure there were folks who were very concerned about that change. But this is what spearheaded getting the sewer, getting the water, getting the interchange from 270, all the ingredients that were going to make things happen. So it didn't take long for the residents of Muirfield to become a very big piece of the population of Dublin. Mm-hmm. And I think the stuff that attracted them to Muirfield became the same principles and policies that guided Dublin's larger planning effort on that. Anytime you go from kind of rural village status to a more urban form, there's going to be controversy and there's going to be folks who are going to want to keep things the same on that. I think that changed pretty quickly as we went to 14,000 people, 16,000 people by 1990, over 40,000 people today. Very quickly as it began to suburbanize around this development, Muirfield really became the starting point for folks who developed those policies, adopted those legislations.
When you were talking about the changing demographics earlier, I couldn't help but think about the schools.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a lot of construction over the last 25, 30 years. The sprawl has been reflected more than anything, ultimately, in the schools. What about that? How much does the city work with the district in terms of planning ahead going forward?
That's a very good question. I mean, I think you see suburbs, even see Upper Arlington, go through the cycles it did in terms of the size of its school district when it was in the peak home buying years and families were at their peak size. And then you kind of saw folks aging in place, school district got smaller, next generation folks come in, buy with kids, starts to go up. We've been working very closely with Superintendent Dublin Schools and other officials on trying to coordinate kind of our planning and thinking long term, because in reality, we need to have common sets of assumptions that we're making with regard to development and housing, because mm-hmm. it's the same taxpayers paying for these significant facilities. And one of the big things we just accomplished with the school district was a very substantial tax incentive arrangement for the Bridge Street District that kind of advances the interests, we think, of both parties. But looking very closely at housing types, we believe that the vast majority of demand for new housing isn't going to be housing with kids. Demographics pretty show that pretty strongly. But Dublin is going to continue to be a family-dominated area. The single-family neighborhoods that make up most of Dublin will continue to be here and predominate, and it's in our interest to help continue that. We think things like Bridge Street actually add value to those surrounding residential neighborhoods. It gives them amenities, places to go to, more restaurants, and more future housing options, as well as a feeder network for those neighborhoods in the future.
It's just not designed as a single-family home kind of area. Yeah.
How competitive are other neighborhoods, other suburbs staying with it? We mentioned Upper Arlington earlier. They've put up a bunch of new condos. They've redeveloped Lane Avenue. Worthington is doing the same thing
Westerville redid their downtown as well. And I think you're even seeing Grove City, which is growing like gangbusters. Mm-hmm. They're starting a lot of planning to move some of this residential downtown. So, I mean, I think that the demographic trends that Terry is talking about, you know, they're not just Dublin. I mean, that all of these suburbs are looking to attract those kinds of residents and that kind of development. It's a race to see who can do it first. And you know, quite frankly, Columbus is making a big push in this as well to make it not a suburban phenomenon, but to make it a regional strategy.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher. We're broadcasting live from Nationwide Live Studio at the Memorial Tournament at Muirfield Village in Dublin. We're talking about the changing American suburb. If you have a question or comment, we welcome them. 614-292-8513. My conversation with Terry Fogler from the City of Dublin and also Doug Buchanan of Business First will continue. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. We are live at the Memorial Golf Tournament in Dublin. We're in the heart of the suburban development that started things rolling in Central Ohio 40 years ago. Muirfield And we are broadcasting live from the Nationwide Live Studio at the Memorial Tournament at Muirfield Village in Dublin. We're talking about how Muirfield and other suburbs are changing to meet the needs of changing times. Demographic changes are huge. Still with us is Doug Buchanan, Managing Editor at Business First. Doug, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
And also Dublin's Director of Strategic Initiatives, Terry Fogler. Terry, once again, thanks.
My pleasure.
Joining us now is William Murdoch. He's Executive Director of the Mid-Ohio Regional Planning Commission. William, welcome to the show.
Nice to be here. Thanks, Dan.
William, has Central Ohio stopped sprawling? Is it safe to say that or not necessarily?
Well, you know, we're seeing a lot of big changes, and that's what we're trying to prepare our local governments and our community for. Looking out towards 2050, we're expecting another 500,000 people in this region. And what that growth looks like is going to determine how we invest our infrastructure, where that sprawl or where that additional growth happens. And I know Terry had mentioned earlier, we're seeing big changes in demographics. The demographic spectrum is flattening. We have more young people and more older people, and we're becoming more diverse. We're getting international migration. We're also seeing some pretty big changes in preferences, too, where people are looking for options in housing, options in transportation. And you mix all that together, and to your question, what will the next 500,000 people and the roads and the housing they have look like? That's what we're working on.
Everyone moves out of the subdivisions. What are the plans for them? Everyone won't move out of the subdivisions, ideally. But what? How does it is envisioned that they'll be used 50 years from now?
Yeah. There's a lot of different speculation you'll read in different books by demographers and others who are kind of looking at this trend going forward. I think there's general agreement that the rate at which large lot, single family suburban housing has been built isn't going to be the same. So we know that's there. How much of it, from a new development perspective, we don't know. But I think we do have to be cautious of overbuilding, overplatting, overplanning. If the demographics tell us, as William said, that this population pyramid from an age perspective is now becoming a rectangle, much more senior elements to it, much more diverse. That the diversity, if you look at from Hispanic populations and others, tend to get married more, tend to have larger families. There's indications of population segments that are growing that are going to be seeking this. But I think it's a matter of monitoring, having both at the regional level and local level, data and tools that help us make well-informed planning decisions. I think the fear is now that a lot of the plans that communities, townships, and counties have done have simply extrapolated trends from the last 30, 40 years. That demographic drivers that form that aren't there. And what we need is really good data, really good information to make the best decisions we can so that we have to adjust codes and standards and zoning and living arrangements to kind of accommodate changing demographics. We're doing it with the best data and the best information possible.
William Murdoch, from where the Mid-Ohio Regional Planning Commission sits, what transportation issues do current suburbs face? We've talked a little bit about 270 and 33 and the impact that interchange had on the development going east. What about the rest of the region and transportation?
Well, there's two things that I think address that. And one is planning for these changes and the growth. Roads and transportation infrastructure is expensive, and we're in an environment where funding is being reduced, but the needs are increasing as we're growing, and that's a challenge that a lot of our suburban communities are grappling with, is how do we address that? How do we plan for that? How do we invest in infrastructure that we're going to need 20 years from now? At the same time, we're seeing a very strong interest, even in our suburban communities, for more options. They have greater expectations for transit. They're seeing what's happening in downtown Columbus with car sharing and ride sharing and bike sharing, and they want to provide those same kind of services for their communities. And that's where MORPC's role is to help those local governments navigate that and figure out where the money is and how to get those options and how to plan for some of these big changes that are coming down the line.
Well, we see the car sharing and the bike sharing in Columbus, Terry Fogler and Doug Buchanan. Do you see that sort of atmosphere of share and that kind of thing expanding out to the suburbs?
Absolutely. I mean, Dublin's always prided itself on kind of bike paths and those kind of elements. We've gotten, I think, better recently in getting bikes in roadways as opposed to just bike paths as a transportation route. In Bridge Street in particular, we're looking I mean, cycle tracks are a major part of the streetscape element. We are even having transit consultants come in to help us prepare for those needs. The challenges with suburbs and transit is that it's the totally wrong development form currently for transit. Transit wants linear streets. It wants density and walkability.
They don't want, you mean the cul-de-sacs just don't do it for a city bus.
The ridership numbers just don't work. So part of it is a what comes first issue. Do you create enough density, walkability, and nodes where transit becomes possible? I think Bridge Street in Dublin becomes Dublin's long-term most transit serviceable node. So we need to plan for it now, and we are as a part of it. But a lot of it's about more walkability. We're looking at capturing probably 30-40% of the trips long-term in Bridge Street for work, food, entertainment pieces. The mixing of uses can do a lot to that. So enhancing walkability, enhancing the use of bike, which I think will be a very strong element there, and transit that connects us to the both internally but to the larger regional system are important goals.
Doug Buchanan?
But there's very little support right now for like a light rail option, or you know, a regional, as William was saying, a regional transit option. It's just not going to happen, and you know, certainly in the near future. So I do think that these ride sharing options or bikes paths, you know, they're smaller things that suburbs can do and can control that don't require statewide options, federal options, regional options. And so I do think you will see those before you see those kinds of things.
I think Terry brought it up earlier, Doug. We were talking about how to attract the smart, new, young talent, because that's going to be where the growth is going to come from.
Right.
And for some, looking at a big glass structure kind of jutting out of a suburban sprawl is not attractive to them. They don't want to have to drive 25 minutes to get to work.
Right. I mean, I think it's part and parcel to what Terry has been saying about this trend toward infill development and you know, tighter walkable communities. If you are living in an area that is, you know, within walking distance to work and walking distance, or at least biking distance, to entertainment options, then that takes the need away for, you know, a big multi-node rail system.
Mm-hmm. Bill in Clintonville, you're on the air. Welcome. Hi, Bill.
I wanted to say I'm kind of amazed that there's one word I have barely heard during this whole discussion, and that is the word community. It seems to me that one reason the suburbs are trying to change is that people are realizing that the stereotype 1960s suburb in some ways did not offer community. It offered material wealth, but it didn't really maybe offer as much of a feeling of neighborhood as people had hoped. And I think people are hungry for living in a real neighborhood, a real community where they know their neighbors, they have events, they can trust their neighbors. They're not just living next to a shopping mall so that they can enjoy the latest trendy restaurant. Instead, they're seeking something deeper, I think. I don't know. Can you just react to that, respond to that idea?
Bill's calling from Clintonville, where everybody has a front porch. Out in the suburbs, everyone has a back porch, at least, if they're lucky, a screened-in porch. What about that? It is a different mood when you move to the suburbs.
I mean, I think part of the idea is that there needs to be a broad range of housing types. I think there was an article in the paper this weekend that was showing housing values in a number of the urban and suburban neighborhoods, some of which now are much higher than they were at their pre-recession highs. Folks, in terms of housing availability in some of the suburban markets, it's almost non-existent. So the demand is there. Folks are wanting it, and there's very little supply of it in a number of locations. Other locations, there's excess supplies. But the broad range of housing types to be able to accommodate folks at different stages of their life based on what they're seeking, and looking at the demographics to understand how those are going to kind of frame those things going forward, should create a massive amount of regional options that are both suburban and urban. Chris Leinberger with the Brookings Institute came to town recently and gave an analysis. He said most of this dense urban walkable stuff nationally is happening in suburban settings.
on there. So a lot of it's going to continue to happen there, while at the same time the urban neighborhoods, urban core, I think are going to continue. This broad range of housing types and neighborhood types, I think only strengthens the region's competitiveness in the long term.
William Murdoch?
Yeah, I think Bill's spot on with his community comment. A lot of our suburban communities really value that, and we have people who are very passionate about their communities, but at the same time they don't see the options. So they want their kids to be able to have apartments when they move out of the house. When they retire, they want to downsize, but they love Dublin or they love up Arlington and they want to stay in that community. And the demographic changes we're seeing, the market forces we're seeing, could actually provide that in communities like Dublin and others that are planning for this, where they can have different options to meet all these different community needs as people go through their lives.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're broadcasting from the Nationwide Live Studio at the Memorial Tournament at Muirfield Village in Dublin. We're talking about America's new suburbs. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. The high-density housing means more people, more cars in one place. So we're talking about handling traffic, but the way of handling traffic nowadays is not necessarily gigantic 6, 7, 8-lane highways. That's a big turnoff. William Murdoch, what about that? Are we done expanding our highways, all things being equal?
Sure. I mean, well, you know, Columbus is a global logistics hub, so highways are an important part of that. They're an important part of our transportation system. But at the same time, at MORPC, our member communities have really emphasized what we call complete streets. And that's building transportation ways that can accommodate cars and trucks and people walking and people on bicycles and transit and different transit types. And building that component into each new investment that we're making is a really critical concept for us, so that we're addressing those diverse needs and we're creating a network that serves all the users.
Doug Buchanan, we've been talking about what the demographic change agents are going to be looking for. What are businesses looking for now? You know, Ashland's not going anywhere. Nationwide's not going. No one's really necessarily going anywhere. But
well, I mean, I'll tell you, they're looking for people. If you look at when a company decides to move within the region or they decide to come to Central Ohio. The workforce is an incredibly important part of that, and so I think if you're looking within the region and you're looking at Dublin versus Grove City or whatever, these kinds of efforts at planning that these cities are doing to encourage the mix of people and the high quality mix of residents, I mean, that's all part and parcel toward attracting these businesses because they want to be where they can attract the best workers. And if you are in a spot that's inconvenient or is just not desirable, then it's going to make it that much harder to keep any kind of good quality workers.
But the cost of starting a business or moving a big business to a place like Central Ohio is much more expensive when you look at going into a built-up area that's already developed. It's always been easier just to start something new at a greenfield somewhere outside.
Well, depending on the incentive, I mean, I think that the cities are doing a lot as mm-hmm. well to encourage redevelopment of existing sites. So, you can make the numbers work in a number of different ways, but you know, I think that the key thing is to find the place that works overall, and one component of that is going to be location. Another component is going to be workforce.
Terry Fogler?
Yeah, we interviewed a number of our corporate leaders as well as the young professionals. Mm-hmm. You mentioned the large corporate headquarters, but Dublin has thousands of companies, very small companies, mm-hmm. in lease space. How do you keep that lease space full and attractive in the long term? Is the suburban office park environment yeah. where employers of the future are going to want to be? So we're doing a lot of analysis right now on our what is now older suburban office development. How do you make that competitive in the long term?
Mm-hmm.
The idea that companies, I mean, when Dublin and I was working the economic development side and we had Cardinal Health come to Dublin, it was very much about where the CEO wanted to live. Increasingly, what you're hearing on economic development, it's about where workers want to live first. You hear okay. about kind of young
Once
talent
again, the people.
Choosing yeah. to go to Austin or Seattle or these other communities and then finding a place to work. So having environments that mobile young talent wants to live in and work in is
a
really important
piece. And that young
piece.
Talent eventually is going to be running these companies.
Yep.
This is where
yeah.
they want to live. This is, I mean, it's a lot of these companies are run by younger people. It's not like they're all a bunch of graybeards. I mean, they're young people running big companies.
Look at Columbus and Central Ohio in particular, and how many people are actually from here versus how many people have moved here from
yeah.
other parts of Ohio, from Northeast Ohio, especially
right.
where I'm from. I mean, it's an attractive place to live, and that's going to continue bringing in more people versus, say, a Cleveland or even a Cincinnati.
Yeah, I think the growth that William mentioned for Central Ohio, that's an aberration in Ohio. You take out what Central Ohio is doing, and Ohio's losing population in a significant way. So
yeah.
so it's a very different environment here. The prospects for growth, I think, are much, much different, and the ability to attract and retain young talent, I think, among all the things that will define our economic success, is a major factor we have to consider.
Yeah, that growth makes us very fortunate in Central Ohio when we're looking at these new types of infill development, both in the suburbs and the inner city. When you're a business, you have to do what makes financial sense for you.
Mm-hmm.
And in a lot of these areas, like our inner city, our downtown core and our suburban areas, the infrastructure is already there. The zoning's already there. There's people already there, and the cost of redeveloping might be a little more
right.
Just for a building in that kind of environment, but the infrastructure's there, and that's paid for. And all of a sudden, the equation has shifted when we're seeing these changes in demand, and it makes revitalization a really attractive option for a lot of businesses, and having population growth helps with that.
Yeah.
Sue in Galloway, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Sue.
Thank you, Ann. I'm really interested in this topic because I've moved in and out of Columbus due to job transfers and whatnot. When I first came to Columbus, I think it was 1981, I was told the coolest places to live were behind the Westland Mall in the continent.
Mm-hmm.
So I was here for about 5 years, married, moved away, came back about 15 years later, and those places didn't look like they did when I lived there. So how
yeah.
do you guys figure this out? How do you try to figure out?
And I'd, on top of that, Sue, I'd like to add, you guys aren't just looking at 10 years ahead. You're trying to look to 2050, 2060, on down the road. Sue, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think another aspect of that is, I mean, the continent was very much kind of a, you could call it Disney-esque or contrived, but it tried to make itself look like a French place that wasn't. I think the important lessons we learned from those things, and Easton even helps us learn those things.
They didn't fool us.
No,
huh?
No. We after a couple of visits, I kind of said, this ain't Paris.
And
but the notion that you're building real urban places that are really, I mean, why do we love the short north? It's real urban.
Yeah.
You can create it new. Look at what Arena District and Grandview Yards and other
areas
are doing.
It's authentic.
It's authentic.
Mm-hmm.
So the notion, how do you do a 21st century version of this and these environments, is really part of the planning challenge that we have. But we believe that the more it's authentic, real mixing of uses on real streets that has both cars and people that are serving real functions on there, just like the Short North has survived for all of these years because it has those elements, is much more durable.
I think that's sort of what Bill was getting at, Bill from Clintonville, the caller,
that definitely.
It's a real community. It's not out of thin air. There's at least has to be that feeling mm-hmm. for a lot of people mm-hmm. that it's real. And now, of course, Dublin's very, very real, mm-hmm. very, very successful.
Right. I mean, I think Clintonville has been around for a long, long time, right. and it has successive generations of people living there, and so it has developed in that way. Dublin is very young,
mm-hmm.
Relative to that. So, you know, as we're talking about, it was the dream of a couple of people to really develop that, and now it's, you know, at another stage of its growth. I don't know if that's middle age or what it is, but now is a time when city planners are taking a step back and deciding, what is Dublin going to look like in the next 20 or 30 years for this next generation of residents coming in? And this infill idea certainly looks like it's going to work.
Right. Well, and there's we're talking a lot about the qualitative aspect of what this new growth looks like, and I'm the city planner at the table. Well, I guess Terry's a city planner too. But we really focused on the quantitative aspect, and Our local governments in Central Ohio weren't looking for MORPC or anybody to come up with a plan to tell them where and what development needs to look like. They wanted us to build a toolkit for them to evaluate these choices so they can make informed decisions. And I got to put a plug in for it because Terry's working on it too. We've got a big project we kicked off with the business community called Insight 2050, and we're have that long horizon where we're looking out to 2050 and we're trying to help look at all sorts of metrics, transportation, financial, environmental, quality of life, household impacts, to help our communities make good decisions about some of these qualitative choices. And that's what we're trying to do to help them get prepared for it.
Well, William Murdoch, thanks for joining us today to talk about it.
Thank you.
William Murdoch, he's Executive Director of the Mid-Ohio Regional Planning Commission. Also, Terry Fogler, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Terry Fogler, he's Dublin's Director of Strategic Initiatives. Coming up, we're going to take a closer look at the golf course development and the future of golfing and how it fits into that larger American suburb. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher. We're broadcasting from the Nationwide Live Studio at the Memorial Tournament at Muirfield Village in Dublin. It's 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. This morning, we're live at the Memorial Golf Tournament in Dublin. We are broadcasting from the Nationwide Live Studio there. The game of golf is alive and well today by any measure if you're looking around the tournament, but there is concern that golf has been on a slowly fading trajectory. The National Golf Foundation estimates 25 million Americans play golf, but the foundation also predicts 20% could quit the game in the next few years. 263 courses have closed over the past decade, including 34 in Ohio alone. Still with us is Doug Buchanan, Managing Editor at Business First. Doug, once again, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And joining us now is Mark Jackis. He's Chief Marketing Officer for Nationwide Insurance, the sponsor of the Memorial Tournament. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And thanks so much for having us at your beautiful studio here.
Thank you. You know, we put this in about 2 years ago, and I really appreciate you all coming out here, WOSU, and I would encourage all the fans that are listening, when they come out to the Memorial Tournament, swing by here and check it out. Most people don't believe they can actually walk up and see you, Ann, broadcasting right here, but they can.
They really can. I'm here, and it's gorgeous, and I know that this is like tempting fate, but rain, bring it on, because we could handle it in this place.
We do our anti-rain dance.
This is going to be one of the most beautiful weekends I think I can ever remember for the Memorial.
I'll take it.
All right. So the game of golf. Despite the great weather, despite the crowds that'll be showing up today and the next few days for the tournament, it's struggling. It was booming back in the 90s when Tiger Woods burst onto the scene. Doug Buchanan, how much is the game of golf a business that you even really follow that much anymore?
Well, I mean, it's still a big business, and it has an enormous impact, especially here in Central Ohio, because of the Memorial. But as a sport, as a sport, it is in decline, and so whether it will continue to be as big a business is an open question. Jack Nicklaus recently said that there are three problems with golf: it's too hard, it takes too long, and it's too expensive. And he has been out front and trying to encourage new ways of playing, easier ways of playing, to get the younger people involved, because the demographics just don't look good as far as the number of new people taking up the sport versus the number of older people who are cycling out.
Mm-hmm. What about Nationwide? When it's put its money behind this tournament, so there's still a lot of to gain by doing that.
Absolutely. You know, recreationally, we support what Doug was mentioning. Jack Nicklaus has talked about, 12 holes or the cup. The standard cup size is 4 inches. You can make it 8 inches. You can
to get those guys off the green.
So, speed up the game, exactly.
He actually does that out here at Muirfield Village once a year, and he'll experiment with that. So we think that makes a lot of sense. As far as the sport, we see two things going on in sport in general. It's not just golf. You've got, if you take the long view, all sports, including golf, are up from 10 or 20 years ago. What we saw before the Great Recession was an unsustainable buildup, and it's coming. It's a reversion to the mean. This is true in just about baseball and hockey and you name it. So we still see sports as a place where the fans have passion. And if you want to get your brand in front of fans in a way that's authentic and connects with them, sports are still a great way to do that, and golf included.
What about the business of golf and residential development?
Well, that's what, as Matt was just saying, it was developed too much. It was overdeveloped. Right. Golf courses as anchors for residential communities and golf courses in general were overbuilt. Right. And now you're starting to see some of that reckoning come through with courses just flat out closing. And other courses, including here in Central Ohio, being turned into complete residential developments. They're just plowing them over and building houses. And the reason is because they're not sustainable as golf courses. They're not making enough money. And as the developers are looking for places to put housing, they happen to be very nice areas. They're located nicely. They've got nice features to them. And so they make better use. It just makes more sense to put housing there. We're seeing a few different courses around Central Ohio that's happening to right now, and I would expect a little bit more of that shakeout.
Now, Nationwide, let's talk a little bit about Nationwide real quick before we have to take off. Nationwide Hospital received $10 million gift from Nationwide Insurance Foundation recently, establishing the Nationwide Pediatric Innovation Fund. Nationwide's very picky about where it puts its money. That's a wonderful place to put it. But you also sponsor other events as well. Nationwide sponsors NASCAR, for example.
Right. So if you think about sports and you think about charitable giving, what's the connection? So sports, we're big into PGA Tour, we're big into NASCAR, we're big into the NFL. With respect to the PGA Tour, the PGA Tour gives more than the top four major sports combined, other ones. So if you take hockey and football and basketball and baseball, the PGA Tour gives more. In fact, they just crossed the $2 billion mark. The second thing you think about, the Memorial Tournament, when Jack Nicklaus and Barbara Nicklaus started the tournament, over the last 39 years, they've given over $12 million to Nationwide Children's Hospital. A lot of people don't know that. Obviously, we gave $50 million in 2006, and then we just announced on Tuesday we followed it up with another $10 million to establish the Innovation Pediatric Fund. And so for us, Nationwide Children's Hospital remains the special cornerstone beneficiary. We see golf as a great way to both connect with fans in Central Ohio, but also around the country, just like the hospital serves fans, serves patients in Central Ohio, but also around the country.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. To what extent is Nationwide work on its investments in this way to broaden the audience? The NASCAR audience isn't necessarily the Memorial audience.
That's exactly right. In fact, that's intentional. So you'll see that professional football and race car driving cross-index about 88%. And their seasons are complementary. Football is largely in the winter, race cars in the summer, and it's largely the same fans. Golf is a completely different set of folks, and that's part of the reason why we do golf and car racing and football, is so that it's really surround sound all time. Live sports is still one of the last things you don't DVR.
Right.
People want to consume sports live. And so as an advertiser, you also get a bit of a boost, because people say, listen, if you're authentically connecting with my passion, whether it's golf, race car driving, or football, I'm going to pay more attention to you. And frankly, the statistics will show it's a highly effective form of advertising. It's in a highly effective way to get in front of people versus getting, TiVo'd and sped through and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, as a marketing proposition, golf is still a very good business.
Because people come here and stay day after day after day.
Right. Attendance-wise.
And
then watching as well. And the demographics are, off the charts.
Now, you have some little headphones. Tell us about what...
These are the biggest
hit
out
here.
These
look really
cool. So we partner with SiriusXM Satellite Radio, and we give these away so anybody can come in. They're the biggest hit, and you'll see them. People will be wearing one on their ear. And anywhere on the course. So here's what happens, right? You come here, there's 50,000 people here or whatever, and you'll be on the sixth hole watching something. You'll hear a roar, and you'll think, what the heck is going on? And you have no idea. And so this will tell you immediately what's going on, and, so-and-so just eagled on the 12th or whatever, so.
So you can listen while you watch.
Yes.
And they're free. You can get them at the Nationwide Live Studio and elsewhere, or is
yes, you can get them all around the course. You can certainly get them at the Nationwide Live Studio and other entrance places. They are free, but there are limited supplies, so people should swing by, and we have some every day that we're out here.
If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. I'm talking with Doug Buchanan, Managing Editor at Columbus Business First, and also...
Matt
Jockus, he's Chief Marketing Officer at Nationwide. Doug Buchanan, how sometimes businesses fall off from sponsorships. How do they, what, how big of a deal is it to sponsor things? On the other hand, it seems like every building is named for some, every athletic type of venue is named for a business nowadays. That's pretty normal.
Right. Right, but you know, in some of these venues, if you've seen, they cycle through names fairly quickly, as well. I mean, so it's a dance between the sport and the team, and the corporations to see not only is it a good match, but is the corporation financially viable enough to keep that name on there, and branding wise. Is it a good choice? You don't just want to partner with anybody. And so, you know, I think from Nationwide's perspective, you know, they're a big name here in Columbus. And I think that's why, you know, you see them come back. Because you did the Nationwide Tour.
That's right.
Which is the, you know, the minor league tour. But that was more of a national sponsorship. And then they came back and, you know, still get plenty of national exposure with, a tournament here in Columbus, but it is, you know, Columbus's tournament. So I think it helps them locally as well.
That's right.
Well, Doug Buchanan, I want to thank you for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And right now I want to welcome our next guest. One of the biggest stars in the game of golf in the early 2000s. She was right up there with Tiger Woods. Annika Sorenstam won more than 70 LPGA tournaments and 10 major championships. In 2003, she became the first woman to play on the men's PGA Tour. She retired in 2008 to focus on her family. Well, she retired from golf to focus on her family and to start a business. She now owns her own company that designs golf apparel, golf courses, and provides financial advice to world-class athletes. And she helped produce and market ultra-fine wines and wrote a cookbook. She is this year's honoree at the Memorial Tournament. Annika Sorenstam, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
You know, When you left golf, you were still very competitive. You could have stuck around. What did you change? Why did you change careers when you did?
Well, I thought it was time. And to be honest, my heart and told me it's time to do something else. You know, when you stand on the range and you realize that your mind is somewhere else and you win a tournament and you realize that, you know, this doesn't excite me anymore. I have achieved every goal that I set in golf, and I was looking to do other things. I have other passions I wanted to pursue. So, my heart just told me it's time to go. So that was in 2008.
But when you decided to go, you knew you weren't retiring.
Well, no, I never used the R word. I only talked about stepping away. I stepped away from competitive golf. As a matter of fact, I think I'm busier now running the business, but mostly because being a mom of two little kids, a four-year-old and a three-year-old, keeps me very, very busy. It's fun, but, you know, now I juggle more than I used to.
But you're not leashed to a tournament schedule.
Correct. No, yeah. I haven't competed in a serious or in a official LPGA tournament in almost 6 years.
We were talking about the business of golf, mm-hmm. and what do you make of the fall off? Was this in when you're projecting out in your business, were you expecting that? And was it a surprise?
What do you mean? Sorry.
The fall off in participation. They're expecting, you know, fewer people playing golf.
Well, I think that's something we've been seeing the last 10 years or so. I mean, the number that I was given is 5 million people leave the game every year, but 4 million pick it up. So, yes, we're losing some people to the game of golf. And, you know, me and some other players, we work closely with organizations like USGA, RNA, and you know, PGA America, we're trying to get people into the game and stay in the game. I think there's nothing like golf. I mean, golf, you can play for a long period of time. You can play different skill levels. You can play with all kinds of, you know, people. So, you know, why not play golf? I think it's a great sport. So we encourage, especially the young ones, I think that's where the growth is, you know, amongst families, kids, and women especially, to pick up the game. So make it more fun, make it more cool, make it more exciting. So that's, you know, something I work on, I would say, almost every day. I have a foundation, the Annika Foundation, and we do that. We try to inspire junior golfers especially to fulfill their dreams through the game of golf.
My guest is Annika Sorenstam. She is this year's honoree at the Memorial Tournament. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. You founded the Annika Foundation is mm-hmm. what it's called, right? Mm-hmm. It aims to teach children the importance of living a healthy, active lifestyle. What prompted you to pick that cause?
Well, I like kids. I like golf. I like, you know, I've always been very conscious of what I eat. I enjoy working out. I think being healthy is the most important thing in your life. So, you know, I read a lot and I see a lot of news, and what caught my attention a few years ago was all the healthcare costs and looking at, you know, the country in general, especially kids, that 25 million kids nowadays are obese or overweight, and kids in general spend 4 to 5 hours in front of TV, video game, you know, computers, you name it, and we're just not as active as we should be. And I believe in preventive medicine, and preventive medicine is being active, paying attention to what you put in your system. So I said, why don't we just tie them all together? I mean, I grew up playing all kinds of sports. My mom would cook meal for us, so I was, and I studied nutrition in school. So all of these things, they just kind of marry. And I said, I want to make a difference. I want to get back to the game, but I also want to inspire the young ones to really think about the choices they make, because I think now, you make them when you're young. It's about a lifestyle. It's not just, you know, a conscious thinking for a week or two. This is a lifestyle change, and we got to do something about it. Otherwise, this country is going to go bankrupt.
Annika Sorenstam, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Golfing legend Annika Sorenstam. She is this year's honoree at the Memorial Tournament. And also, thanks to Matt Jockes, Chief Marketing Officer at Nationwide.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for listening. This is WOSU-FM and HD1 Columbus.